Breaking Through into Buddhahood. Quote from the Dhammapada. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows, like a shadow that never departs. We usually think of the spiritual life in terms of growth, in terms of progress, development, and evolution. Something slow, steady, proceeding by regular, continuous steps. And this concept of gradual evolution is a perfectly valid one, and a very good and helpful way of thinking and speaking of the spiritual life. But we can think of the spiritual life and the spiritual experience in another way, in terms of breaking through, and there are certain advantages in thinking of it in this way. If we think in terms of breaking through, or if you like, of bursting through, it becomes clear that spiritual life consists, in part at least, or from one point of view at least, in an abrupt transition from one level or dimension of experience or one mode of being to another. It draws attention to the fact that the spiritual life involves not just effort, but even violence. The idea that the spiritual life involves violence is not a very popular one, but involve violence it does. Not, of course, violence to others, but violence to oneself, or to certain aspects of oneself that constitute obstacles which need to be overcome. We all come up against these obstacles, these very difficult, obstinate aspects of ourselves, which stand in the way of our higher development and evolution. Sometimes they are very intractable indeed, and we find that they cannot be charmed away by any sort of siren song, nor does it seem possible to remove them or dismantle them bit by bit. There they are in all their intractable tangibility, like great rocks and boulders blocking our path. Sometimes we just have to break through, to burst through, with the help of a sort of charge of spiritual dynamite, regardless of consequences. It cannot always be easy, gradual or smooth. Sometimes it has to be violent and abrupt, even dramatic. We may say that the average spiritual life consists of periods of fairly steady progress, perhaps even apparent stagnation, separated by more or less violent and dramatic breakthroughs. This is the picture, the graph, as it were, of the average spiritual life. There is a period of very slow progress, followed by a breakthrough to another higher level, then another period of slow, steady progress, and then another breakthrough. So we are concerned here with the aspect of breakthrough, and we are going to discuss it under three main headings, which are not mutually exclusive. 1. What one breaks through. 2. How one breaks through, and 3. When and where one breaks through. What one breaks through. In principle, one has to break through everything that is mundane, everything that is conditioned, that is, of this world, that is part and parcel of the samsara, everything that represents a segment or a spoke or an aspect of the wheel of life. But this statement, though true, is too general. The mundane, the conditioned, the samsara, has so many different aspects, which are like so many thick impenetrable veils, like so many barriers or roadblocks, so many great boulders piled high in our path, all of which have to be broken through. I'm going to discuss just four of the more important blockages or important aspects of the conditioned, of the mundane, that have to be broken through if Buddhahood is to be attained. First of all, negative emotions. Secondly, psychological conditionings. Thirdly, rational thinking. And fourthly, time sense. Negative emotions. In their primary form, negative emotions are three in number. There is craving, in the sense of neurotic desire. There is hatred, and there is fear. There are also many secondary and tertiary forms, for example, anxiety, insecurity, jealousy, self-pity, guilt, remorse, contempt, conceit, envy, depression, pessimism, gloom, alarm, despondency, despair, suspicion, and resentment. I'm not going to say much about them, as preoccupation with negative emotions is itself very likely to generate negative emotion. All the negative emotions represent leakages or drainings away of emotional energy. When we indulge in negative emotions, whether in their primary, secondary, or tertiary forms, energy, psychical energy, even spiritual energy, is draining away from us in all directions, all the time. Therefore, indulgence in the negative emotions weakens us, and this causes us to withdraw into ourselves, to contract. The effect of indulging constantly and persistently in the negative emotions is that we contract into what we may describe as a cold, hard, tight knot of separate selfhood. Unfortunately, we may say that the negative emotions are extremely widespread, practically all-pervasive, and it seems to be the special function of several ubiquitous agencies to intensify these negative emotions as much as possible. Take, for example, the daily newspapers, many of which specialise in the sensational, the shocking, and the horrible. In this way, negative emotions are stimulated. Then there is the advertising industry, a very large, important, and powerful industry, whose special function seems to be to stimulate neurotic craving, to multiply people's wants rather than to meet their needs. Then again, we find that most people we meet are negative rather than positive in their emotional attitudes and responses. So we have to be very careful not to allow ourselves to be influenced by, to be tinged with, this grey emotional state. We have to break through, to burst through, into a positive emotional state of love, of faith and devotion, of compassion and joy. And we should do our best to encourage positive emotions and attitudes in others. Psychological conditionings. These may be defined as factors which influence, even determine, our mental attitudes and behaviour without our being fully aware of it, or perhaps without our being aware of it at all. Suppose, for instance, we are born in England. We naturally grow up speaking the English language. We are educated in an English school, exposed to all the rigours of the English climate. All this will affect or influence our outlook very deeply, without our being aware of it. It will result in an English psychological conditioning, rather than, say, a French or Chinese psychological conditioning. The natural result will be that we shall look out upon the world as an Englishman and see things from that special point of view. We may be rather surprised when one day we perhaps wake up to the fact that other people in the world see things rather differently. This is just one example, but psychological conditioning is of very many different kinds. We are psychologically conditioned by our race, by our class, and by the work we do. Just think of it. You do the same kind of work, in many cases, so many hours of the day, days of the week, weeks of the year, years of your life, so that you start seeing things in a special way, from the standpoint of your employment, your profession, your occupation, your vocation. Moreover, we are psychologically conditioned by the social and economic system of which we are a part, and by the religion into which we are born or in which we have been brought up. All this goes to show that we are just a mass of psychological conditioning, a class conditioning, plus an economic conditioning, plus a religious conditioning, plus a national conditioning, plus a linguistic conditioning. There is very little, in fact, that is really ours, really our own. There is very little in our lives and experience that is really free and spontaneous, that is really, in a word, us. For the most part, we think, even feel, and certainly act in certain ways because we have been conditioned to do so. For the most part, we are no better than Pavlov's dogs. A bell rings. We react, we respond. And bells are ringing all the time. Religious bells, economic bells, social bells, political bells. The bells go on ringing and ringing, and we respond like mad, and call this our freedom. We may say that, really and truly, we are machines rather than human beings. So we have to break through all these conditionings. We have to shatter, to smash, our own mechanicalness. Otherwise there is no Buddhahood. Not even, in fact, any real spiritual life. This breaking through the barriers and obstacles of psychological conditioning means a sort of de-identification of ourselves, a sort of dissociation from that part of ourselves which is machine-like. Spiritual people, we may say, will not think of themselves as being English, or working class, or middle class, or any class. They won't think of themselves as townspeople if they live in the town, or as country people if they live in the country. The spiritual person won't think of themselves as essentially being a doctor, or a bus driver, or a housewife, and therefore will not think or feel or act out of any such conditioning. He or she will act freely and spontaneously out of the depths of pure, clear awareness. Such a person eventually won't think of himself as being even a human being. If such a person, such a spiritual person, or one might even say transcendental person, thinks at all, which is doubtful, they will think of themselves as a Buddha, and will act as a Buddha, because he or she will have broken through all psychological conditioning, will have broken through into Buddhahood. Rational thinking. This kind of breaking through is indeed difficult to imagine. We can well understand the need for breaking through our negative emotions, which are obviously undesirable. We can understand, with a bit of effort, at least theoretically, the need for breaking through psychological conditioning. But though we understand, it is, after all, our rational mind that is understanding, and now our mind is being asked to contemplate, to agree to, its own dissolution. It's terrifying to experience this even as an idea, even as a thought, even as a concept. The rational mind, we know, is an extremely important faculty. It has been developed over hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, and is the chief instrument of human survival. It is therefore natural that it should be valued very highly, but it should not be overvalued. It is invaluable for practical purposes, After all, it was the rational mind that discovered fire, that invented the wheel, that domesticated animals at the dawn of history, and that forged tools and implements, that established cities and systems of government, that built roads and bridges. More recently, the rational mind, the rational intelligence, has created the aeroplane and radio and television. It is the rational mind that split the atom, and it is the rational mind that is at present dreaming, if you can speak of it as dreaming, of interplanetary and intergalactic travel. But though the rational mind may achieve all this, and even more that we cannot even imagine, the rational mind cannot know reality. In the Buddha's words, or rather word, reality, truth itself, the absolute, the unconditioned, the ultimate, is ataka vachara. Taka, or taka, means rational thinking, rational thought, even logic. And the Buddha says clearly, emphatically, unmistakably, that in order to experience reality, one must go beyond this. One must break through the rational mind, even break down the rational mind. And only then can one break through into Buddhahood. For most people, this is very difficult to accept. The rational mind has achieved so much. We like to think that, with it, we can understand Buddhism, the nature of enlightenment, and Zen. In the West, very many books have been written by all sorts of people about Zen, all written with the rational mind. Whereas Zen is in fact nothing but a gigantic, overwhelming protest against the assumption, the blasphemous assumption even, that the rational mind can know reality. Zen, we may say, most rudely gives the rational mind a violent slap in the face. Usually people like to think that the rational mind is omnipotent, that it can do everything, know everything. They don't like to be asked to contemplate the weakness of the rational mind, or to be reminded of the power of the non-rational. For this reason they react, sometimes rather strongly, to things that remind them of the non-rational, or that makes them feel the presence, even the pulling or the pushing, of the non-rational. This is why some people react rather strongly to things like insanity. It is perhaps rather significant that in this country we lock up the insane, or at least put them away, even the quite harmless ones. In India, by contrast, the insane are allowed to roam freely in the streets of the cities and villages. The Indians are not afraid of the insane, and this is because they are not afraid of the non-rational. Similarly, we tend to be afraid of our violent emotions, which might carry us away out of ourselves, force us to lose control. We tend to like nice, gentle, soft, tame, manageable emotions. We don't like violent emotions. We react rather strongly to drugs, or to surrealist art, or even to people who are a bit different from us. It is rather significant that gypsies are harassed so much by urban district councils and the like. It is because they represent the unharnessable, the unmanageable, the untamable. They all represent for us the power of the non-rational. They all represent the possibility, and also the danger, of breaking through the rational mind. Time sense. One could say that time is security, that is, insecurity, but perhaps this is too cryptic. There are two kinds of time, some people say three or four, but let us say two today. Organic time and mechanical or clock time. By organic time, we mean our own total experience of pure continuous duration, with no thought of before or after, just a direct, immediate present. Here there is no splitting up of the time flow into past, present and future. Mechanical or clock time is the experience of travelling as though along a straight line. This is also sometimes called linear time. It is divided into past, present and future. It is chopped up into hours, minutes, seconds. Organic time, we may say, expands and contracts according to the intensity of one's experience. If one's experience is more intense, then organic time expands. If it is less intense, one's organic time contracts. But clock time is relatively uniform. It is the same all the time. So clock time does not correspond to organic time and cannot measure organic time or one's experience within organic time. When one speaks of breaking through the time sense or breaking through time, one means mechanical time or clock time. Most of us, sad to say, especially those of us who live in cities, are slaves of clock time. We live our lives according to the clock. For example, at 1 o'clock we say it is time to eat, whether or not we feel hungry. In the same way, we work when it is time to work, sleep when it is time to sleep, and even meditate when it is time to meditate, often for no other reason. Our lives are geared to the clock, and in this way the natural self-regulating rhythm of the organism is disrupted, and one's experience of organic time, of pure duration, is lost. Our life's experiences don't emerge and flower from the depths of the eternal now. We see them strung out, like washing on a line, and therefore we mentally anticipate our experiences. We mentally prearrange them. We draw up programs and diaries and so on, because basically we don't trust ourselves to the experience of organic time, of pure continuous duration. We feel insecure. This is why I said that time is security, and therefore insecurity. We like to think within this context of clock time, well, tomorrow is Monday, I'll be doing such and such. Next week I'll be doing this. Next year I'll be doing that. So some people plan and organise their whole lives in this way, right up to the day of retirement. And after that, of course, there is just a blank, a sort of dreary, miserable space before death. And this is a really frightening thought. I suppose it is not altogether our own individual fault, because pressure is brought upon us all the time to live in this way, to regulate our lives and gear our existence to the clock, which means, of course, not really living at all. So, we have to break through the time sense, break through mechanical time. We have, as it were, to smash the clock, or at least allow it to run down. So we must break through negative emotions, through psychological conditioning, through rational thinking, and through the time sense. In this way, from all these four angles and directions simultaneously, we can break through into, or converge upon, Buddhahood. Now, Buddhahood has various aspects which correspond to different aspects of the conditioned, the mundane, the samsara. If we break through the conditioned at a certain point, we shall break through into the corresponding aspect of Buddhahood. If, for instance, we break through the suffering of conditioned existence, we shall break through into the bliss, the happiness, the everlasting joy of Buddhahood. Similarly, with regard to the four aspects of the conditioned with which we have been dealing. Breaking through the negative emotions means breaking through into the positive emotions of love and compassion. Breaking through psychological conditioning means breaking through into a state of complete freedom, spontaneity, and unconditioned creativity. Breaking through the rational mind means breaking through into a state of what we may describe as transcendental non-rationality. Finally, breaking through the time sense means breaking through into the experience of the everlasting, eternal now. Love and compassion, freedom and spontaneity, transcendental non-rationality, and living in the eternal now are all aspects of Buddhahood, and are also characteristics of the enlightened person. The enlightened person will manifest, will radiate, positive emotions, will be completely unconditioned and spontaneous in behaviour, and will therefore be unpredictable. He may be liable to do anything at any moment, will not be bound by rational thinking, and will be quite devoid of any sense of mechanical time, living from moment to moment, and enjoying, as it were, the bliss of pure duration. From all this, we can see that the enlightened person cuts a rather unconventional figure. Some Hindu texts raise the question, how would the liberated, enlightened person appear to others? Within himself, he would know reality, would know God or Brahman, but what would he look like to others? Some of the texts give a threefold reply. They say that the enlightened person will appear like a child, like a madman, and like a ghost. Like a child, because the child is spontaneous and uninhibited. Like a madman, because the enlightened person is in a sense just mad. And like a ghost, because the ghost just comes and goes, you don't know where from or where to. The enlightened person is like that. You cannot tie him down or corner him. You cannot keep track of him. He slips through your fingers. There is also something a little uncanny about him. The enlightened person, one may say, will certainly not appear to other people like a respectable and law-abiding citizen. How one breaks through. Breaking through any aspect of conditioned existence, any aspect of the wheel of life, is accomplished mainly through the cultivation of awareness, mindfulness, and recollection. Awareness, we may say, is the great dissolver of negative emotions, of psychological conditionings, in fact, every aspect of the conditioned within ourselves. There is no spiritual life without awareness. An action, thought, or feeling is spiritual to the extent that it is accompanied by awareness. If there is anything negative in the thought, feeling, or action, anything that smacks of the conditioned, then the awareness with which it is done, if that awareness is maintained, will sooner or later eat away at all the conditioning and negativity. So, awareness is of paramount importance in the spiritual life. There is no spiritual life, no breakthrough, without awareness. Breaking through is also accomplished by means of regular spiritual practice of one kind or another. Puja, making offerings, meditation, giving dana. Every time one practices, an effect is produced. The practice may be very little, very limited, but there is an effect. If you keep up the limited practice, and if it is regular, daily, even hourly, then the effect accumulates within the form of what the Yogacara calls the good seeds. If we keep up the regular practice long enough, these good seeds within us, these wholesome effects, will accumulate to the point of bursting, and there will be a breakthrough. But of course, if we do things in this way, we must have patience. An example often given is that of the rock which is split by the 20th blow. The first 19 were not useless, though they did not appear to have any effect. Without them, the 20th blow could not have done its work. So this is another way of breaking through, keeping up these strokes, that is, the regular practice, month after month, year after year, 10, 20, 30 years. The effects accumulate, tensions accumulate, and then one breaks through. Breakthrough is also achieved by the introduction into one's life of a new factor, especially of a new person. Something or someone who jolts us out of our accustomed routine, who breaks up our accustomed routine, who gets us to some extent out of our conditioning. How does one break through the four aspects of the conditioned already mentioned? One breaks through negative emotions principally by cultivating the positive emotions. Here, practices like the Metta Bhavana, the development of universal loving-kindness, though rather difficult, help very much. One can also break through negative emotions by associating more with people who are emotionally positive, who are either full of love and compassion, of joy and confidence, or even just ordinary cheerfulness. Also, eating the right kind of food can help, not the kind that clogs the system and weighs you down, making you feel heavy and stiff and lethargic. One can also break through into the positive emotions, to some extent, by living more in the open air, by staying in the sunshine as much as possible, looking at green grass and blue sky, and by surrounding oneself with bright colours. Perhaps one should dress more brightly, more colourfully, because this too has a positive emotional effect. One breaks through psychological conditionings, mainly, of course, through awareness. Awareness that one is conditioned, is mechanical, is not free. But how does one develop this sort of awareness? How does one extend and amplify it? One can sometimes do this by subjecting oneself, quite deliberately, to an unfamiliar type of conditioning. If, for instance, one's psychological conditioning is English, then one could go and live for a time in Italy, or India, or Japan. In this way, one will become aware of one's own conditioning, because one will have become aware of the unfamiliar conditioning of the people in the midst of whom one is living. Their conditioning will impinge, sometimes rather uncomfortably, on your conditioning. For instance, people in India eat with their fingers. At first, English people are often very shocked by this and think it terribly unhygienic. After a time, however, you get used to it, and you realise that it was because of your own conditioning that you were shocked. So, to the extent that you become aware of your own conditioning, to that extent you become free from it. For this reason, it is very good to travel and see new countries, meet new people of different races, religions, colours, and cultures. As we get older, and we're getting older every day, the general tendency is to visit only the old familiar places. We say, "Ah, well, I'll go back there. I went there 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I've been there maybe every year for 10, 15, 20 years. Let's have another holiday there. It's the same old hotel keeper, the same old beach. It hasn't changed a bit." In this way, we travel in the same old rut over and over again. Breaking through rational thinking is rather more difficult to do. Traditionally, there are several ways. The Perfection of Wisdom literature employs the method of paradox. A paradox has been defined or described as a truth standing on its head to attract attention, but it's really much more than that. The paradox is a using of conceptual thought to transcend conceptual thought. In the Perfection of Wisdom texts, for instance, the Buddha says that the Bodhisattva, the one who wants to gain enlightenment for the sake of all, must vow to save all beings. He must vow, "I'll deliver, I'll save, I'll help all beings in the universe." And then, the Buddha goes on to say, he must at the same time realize that no beings exist. Otherwise, he is not a bodhisattva. In the same way, the texts say that the bodhisattva must go all out for enlightenment, practice the perfections, the paramitas, sacrifice life and limb, shed his blood. At the same time, he must realize that there is no such thing as enlightenment, and no one attains it. This is the paradoxical approach of the Perfection of Wisdom literature, which really brings the intellect right up against it. This sort of method or approach is exemplified, is crystallized, in the koan of Zen. I'm not going to try to define a koan, but those of you who have studied the literature on Zen, admittedly literature written mainly with the rational mind, know that the koan is very much used in Zen, especially in the Rinzai school, and that it is a sort of apparently contradictory or even nonsensical statement. For instance, when you clap your two hands together, you produce a clapping sound. So the koan says, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" Or the master says to the disciple, "What are you carrying?" The disciple replies, "I'm not carrying anything." And the master says, "Well, drop it then." There are hundreds of such koans, and in the traditional system, the disciple sits in the meditation hall, meditating on one or another of them, hour after hour, for days and weeks on end. We are told that sometimes he breaks out in a sweat. He doesn't know whether it is snowing or raining, whether it is spring or autumn, day or night. He is just stuck with this koan, which sometimes becomes like a great lump of ice, or like a red-hot iron ball that he has swallowed. He cannot get it up, and he cannot get it down. But eventually he breaks through, he bursts through the rational mind. This method presupposes a great faith in the master, and a strong traditional system of discipline, and is therefore rather difficult to transplant to the West. But there are other ways of breaking through the rational mind, not perhaps so drastic as the koan method, but certainly still effective. We can, for instance, have more recourse to non-conceptual modes of communication. We can have more recourse to things like myths, legends, and symbols, all of which are nowadays coming more and more into their own. Formerly, when people translated the Buddhist scriptures, they just cut out all the so-called mythical bits, saying that the monks had inserted these much later, and that only the rational bits were the real bits, and what the Buddha had actually said. Fortunately for us, Jung has rather altered all that, and has taught us to appreciate and to evaluate these things rather differently. So we have put all the mythological bits back, and when we read them, we find that they speak to us, that they have a meaning, though not a conceptual meaning. They have a message, they have an impact. There is something that carries over from them above and beyond, or even round about and underneath, the rational mind. These myths, these symbols, whether the ladder down which the Buddha came from heaven to earth, or his seven steps, or his encounter with the earth goddess under the Bodhi tree, or Muchalinda, all help to communicate the non-conceptual, trans-conceptual truth of Buddhism, of the Buddha's enlightenment. So we shouldn't think that communication is only conceptual, only verbal, only a matter of ideas and thoughts and philosophies. We must try to emphasize the importance of the non-conceptual, the mythical, the symbolical, if you like, of the archetypal, the direct, the experiential. Breaking through the time sense. We can make a very good beginning by doing without a watch. One can also, to some extent, break through mechanical time by having a job which does not oblige one to live according to the clock, where one will not have regular hours, if that is possible. This, I appreciate, is rather difficult to do, except, of course, for people like artists, who can work, we are told, just when they feel like it, without having to stick to any deadline or programme, or to keep their eye on the clock. Where and when one breaks through. One may say that the most favourable conditions for breaking through are the unfavourable ones. Usually, one does not break through when things are going well, when it is all plain sailing, when everything is going according to plan. One is more likely to break through in times of crisis. The Buddha sweated and struggled and starved himself for 6 years, and he seemed, to himself at least, to be no nearer his goal. So, according to legend, he sat down under the Bodhi tree and clenched his teeth and said, "Flesh may wither away, blood may dry up, but until I have gained enlightenment, I'm not getting up from this seat." So for him it was enlightenment or death. This was the crisis for him, the crisis which, in a sense, he created for himself. Some people have been known to break through at a time of physical deprivation. It is as though the weakening of the body strengthens the spirit. Some people have been known to break through when undergoing a prolonged fast. Sometimes, strange to say, one can break through when one is ill. This would seem to be a very unfavourable time. You cannot meditate, sometimes you cannot read. But many people have had important breakthroughs, in fact, crucial breakthroughs, at such times. For instance, when you get a high fever, especially in the East, this is the case. Though you have got the fever, though in a sense you are sick, even suffering, you are sort of strangely exhilarated, and awareness can be intensified, and you can have a breakthrough at that time. You can also have a breakthrough when you have had a shock of some kind, when you have suffered a great bereavement, or when you have lost an enormous sum of money, or your plans have been laid in ruins, or everything has gone hopelessly astray, contrary to your expectations, when you seem to have no hope and no prospects. Sometimes in conditions like this, you will have a breakthrough. According to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, one can break through even at the time of death. Death, in a sense, is the greatest crisis, the most crucial situation of all. It also therefore represents the greatest opportunity. According to the tradition which is embodied in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, at the time of death, and just after death, one experiences, at least momentarily, what is known as the clear light of the void, the light of reality shining, as it were, upon one. Transcendental though it is, awe-inspiring though it is, this is not anything that comes from outside. It is the light, the great white light, of one's own true mind, which is identical, ultimately, in its absolute depths, with reality itself. If one can only recognize this, at that moment, either during the time of death or just after death, then one is liberated, and there may be for one no more rebirth. In these pages, we have tried to understand what we break through, how we break through, and when and where we break through. Inevitably, our approach has been rather conceptual, even though at the same time, the limitations of the conceptual have been indicated. I would like to end with a picture of breaking through, a picture from Tibetan Buddhism, from the Tantric tradition. It is a picture, an image, a form, of what is known as a wrathful deity, or even a wrathful Buddha. What does this wrathful figure look like? How does he appear? First of all, he is a dark blue male figure, very powerfully built, with a massive torso, enormous legs, and enormous arms. Sometimes naked, sometimes draped in tiger skin, He wears a garland of human skulls. He has a third eye in the middle of his forehead. All three eyes glare with an expression of terrible, terrific anger. From the mouth there stick out fangs and a red, blood-dripping tongue. This fearful, dark-blue figure tramples on enemies, upon ignorance, upon craving. And his hands, sometimes 2, sometimes 4, sometimes 8, sometimes 16, sometimes 32, grasp various weapons. What does this figure, this form, represent? This is the image of breaking through. This fearful, or this wrathful, or this terrific form represents the forces of enlightenment breaking, even bursting, through the thick, dense darkness of ignorance and unawareness. This form, this image, represents transcendental consciousness at the point of, at the moment of, breaking through into Buddhahood. The whole figure is surrounded by an aureole of flames. And what does the aureole of flames represent? Breaking through on any level, with regard to any medium, entails friction, just as, when a spacecraft re-enters the Earth's atmosphere, there is tremendous friction. Friction generates heat, and heat, when it reaches a certain point, a certain pitch of intensity, results in a conflagration, in a bursting into flames. So the wrathful Buddha, bursting through the conditioned, is therefore surrounded by this aureole of flames. And these flames consume and burn up the darkness, burn up everything conditioned. And when everything conditioned is burnt up, is consumed, is broken through, then breaking through into Buddhahood is complete, is accomplished. Then there is no more darkness, no more friction, no more flames, but only the shining figure of the Buddha, a Buddha, another Buddha, seated beneath the Bodhi tree. Poem by Sangrakshita entitled, I Want to Break Out. I want to break out, batter down the door, go tramping black heather all day on the windy moor, and at night, in hayloft or under hedge, find a companion suited to my mind. I want to break through, shatter time and space, cut up the void with a knife, pitch the stars from their place, nor shrink back when, lidded with darkness, the eye of reality opens and blinds me, blue as the sky. The end of Breaking Through into Buddhahood.